Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading True West Magazine, July-August 2024 edition. Catching a Killer by Chris Ince. How Bill Tigman's hunt for the outlaw Bill Doolin made the Oklahoma lawman a legend. When legendary lawman Bill Tigman was killed in the line of duty in November 1924, his distraught wife, Zoe, was left with $80 and the monumental task of caring for their three sons alone. Inspired by the women who had penned books about their accomplished husbands, including Elizabeth Custer, who was married to General George Armstrong Custer, and Jesse Benton Fremont, who was married to explorer John Fremont, Zoe hoped a book written by Tigman would bring him the recognition she felt he deserved and provide necessary revenue. According to Zoe, "My husband was one of the West's greatest peace officers. He hunted down famous outlaws and killed when he had to. But Tigman was more than a expert gunman who fought on the side of the law. He and other men who held dangerous jobs as sheriffs and marshals did the work of civilization along the whole frontier." Zoe was already a respected author who had written several published articles and poems for various magazines. Her first book, titled The Dugout, was about the life of early Oklahoma pioneers and was scheduled to be printed by Harlow's Publishing Company, a subsidiary of the newspaper where she was employed, in the fall of 1924 after Tigman was killed. In early 1925, she persuaded Victor Harlow, the founder of the publishing firm, to invest in a manuscript based on the life and services of the slain marshal. She had no way of knowing the tragedies and trials she'd experience would keep her from completing the book until the late 1940s. The content of the book did not pose a difficulty. Bill Tigman was a legend who had lived an adventurous life. But Zoe was dealing with the death of one of her sons and the arrest of another for murder. The Man with the Star. William Matthew Tigman was born on July 4, 1854, at Fort Dodge, Iowa. He entered the field of law enforcement in 1874 and remained in the profession for more than 50 years. He rode with well-known peace officers Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson, and was referred to by his closest lawman friends as the greatest of all of us. Tigman was celebrated by city officials and territorial politicians for his work. In 1905, he was honored by President Theodore Roosevelt for his dedication to law and order on the frontier. At a public tribute to the officer, the president remarked that Bill Tigman was the kind of man who would charge hell with a bucket. Among the many stories about the marshal included Zoe's work with the lawman's capture of outlaw Bill Doolin. Tigman tracks down Doolin. In the summer of 1895, Tigman learned that a man matching Bill Doolin's description had been seen in a Kansas City town east of Dodge City known as Burden. The deputy U.S. marshal traveled to the area and discreetly discovered that Doolin had visited Burden to buy supplies. Dressed as a tenant farmer, the outlaw drove a tired team and wagon to complete the disguise. When Tigman found out the location of the farm where Doolin was staying, he made his way there. The house was next to a ravine surrounded by trees, and the lawman was able to observe the comings and goings undetected. Necessity kept Doolin away from the secluded spot, but his wife and baby were inside, Tigman noted in his journal. The deputy U.S. marshal kept watch over the home and its inhabitants, waiting for the gang leader to appear. Doolin never showed, but his wife Edith eventually left the cabin with her bags and child in tow. Tigman followed a safe distance behind her as she drove her wagon to the train depot in Burden. Mrs. Doolin purchased a ticket to Perry, Oklahoma, and sent a telegram to her father, who lived near there, letting him know she was coming to visit. Tigman decided to check with the Burden postmaster to find out what mail, if any, Mrs. Doolin had received since she had been in the Kansas town. Doolin hadn't written to her at all, but Mrs. Pierce, the owner of the hotel in Ingalls, corresponded frequently. Tilghman then took a trip to Ingalls to have a talk with Mrs. Pierce. The innkeeper was less than forthcoming about her association with the Doolins. It wasn't until the lawman mentioned a train robbery in Texas and suggested the Doolin-Dalton gang was responsible that Mrs. Pierce's tongue loosened. In defending the Doolin-Dalton gang and its leader, she let it slip that Doolin was in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, getting help for his rheumatism. Armed with key information, Tilghman rode to Guthrie to report to Marshal Evett Dumas, E.D. Nix. Nix knew Tilghman was anxious to be on his way to Arkansas and suggested the officer take other deputies with him to help capture Doolin. Nix reminded him of the outlaw's threats to not be taken alive. Doolin had promised to kill any lawman who tried to arrest him as well. Tilghman assured the marshal he had a plan to get the job done. When Bill Tilghman stepped off the train in Eureka Springs, he was dressed as an itinerant preacher, complete with a long black coat and derby hat. As he proceeded down the main thoroughfare, clutching a Bible in his hand, he noticed a tall man, bent at the waist, walking with a cane. The man's complexion was pale, and he carried himself as though he was in pain. But there was no mistaking, he was Bill Doolin. Tilghman followed the fugitive to a barbershop. There, Doolin made himself comfortable in front of a warm stove and began reading a paper he had tucked under his arm. The lawman walked into the room, scanning the setting for other patrons. No one paid any attention to the lawman masquerading as a minister until he pulled a pistol from his suit pocket and pointed it at Doolin. "Put up your hands," Tilghman ordered. The outlaw jumped to his feet and attempted to go for his six-shooter. The seasoned officer jerked Doolin's gun arm back before his hand reached the holster. Bystanders scurried out of the business, leaving Tilghman alone with the combative criminal. "Bill, you know who I am?" Tilghman asked Doolin. "Yes, I do," he replied. "Well, you better get your hands up," the lawman told him. The desperado complied. After confiscating Doolin's gun, he handcuffed him and led him out of the barbershop. The fact that Doolin knew him accounts for the easy manner in which Tilghman took him. The January 16, 1896 edition of the Weekly Oklahoma State Capitol reported, "There is no other marshal that could have gotten him without a desperate fight. Tilghman is the only man on Marshal Nix's force who really made Doolin's capture a study. He was following him incessantly for many months, being very close on his trail several times. The government and the railroad and express companies had outstanding rewards, aggregating to $3,500 for the capture of Doolin, which Tilghman will receive." A crowd of people were waiting at the Guthrie Depot when the train arrived, carrying Tilghman and Bill Doolin. "What are you doing in Eureka Springs?" the Oklahoma State Capitol reporter at the scene asked the outlaw. "I was doctoring my rheumatism," Doolin responded. "I had been there about 2 months. I have not been 100 miles from Oklahoma and the Indian Territory in 2 years. I knew the marshals were after me. Did I know Tilghman? I did not know him very well. I knew the man in front of me in the barbershop with his gun in my face was Bill Tilghman. I looked squarely in his eyes, and I saw in a second that he had the nerve. If it had been anyone else, I would not have hesitated to pull my gun. I saw at once that if I made a move, he would kill me. So I put up my hands." Editor's note: unless otherwise noted, all direct quotes are from the memoirs of William Tilghman, handwritten by William Tilghman, Zoe A. Tilghman, handwritten and typed research notes, Marshal of the Last Frontier. Catching a Killer: How Bill Tilghman's Hunt for Outlaw Bill Doolin Made the Oklahoma Lawman a Legend is an exclusive excerpt of Chris N.'s forthcoming two-dot book, Tilghman, the Legendary Lawman, and the Woman Who Inspired Him, the biography of Zoe Tilghman writing the biography of her husband. True West Magazine, July-August 2024 edition. Hero of Horsepower by J.R. Sanders. Los Angeles lawman William Hamill tamed one of the West's wildest towns with hard work and horseless carriages. Los Angeles, California. Not everyone's picture of a wild and woolly western town, even though Wyatt Earp, who had spent his last years there, claimed Tombstone in its heyday, wasn't half as bad as Los Angeles. Policing the City of Angels and the 4,000-square-mile county of coastline, desert, and mountains encompassing it took a special breed of lawmen, men like Billy Hamill. Native Angeleno William Augustus Hamill was born March 13, 1865. The son of a doctor and educated at Santa Clara University, young Billy, likely to his parents' chagrin, took a brief stab at cowboying in Arizona. He soon returned to California and might have settled in the grocery business, but for his brother-in-law, L.A. County Sheriff George Guard. In mid-April 1885, Malcado Garcia, a notorious horse thief and desperado, had traded gunfire with a deputy sheriff near the San Gabriel Mission. Guard swore in Hamill as a special deputy and sent him and boyhood friend Martin Aguirre, a county constable, on Garcia's trail. They followed it northwest through the Arroyo Seco, and finding Garcia wounded in bed, the deputy's bullet in his chest, 30 miles away at San Fernando, captured him without further gunplay. Thus, in true Old West fashion, Hamill embarked on a career spanning four decades, taking L.A. law enforcement from its horseback days to the mechanized 20th century. A badge well worn. Appointed a regular deputy, Hamill's duties alternated between hazard and routine, arresting cattle rustlers, ferrying convicts to prison, serving papers. He was slightly wounded in a skirmish with another horse thief and stopped a runaway horse and buggy after a firecracker startled the animal. In 1889-90, with Martin Aguirre as sheriff, Hamill further distinguished himself, helping capture a fugitive who had shot and wounded Aguirre, and arresting a fugitive in an 1872 Texas murder. Aguirre's successor, E.D. Gibson, assigned Hamill to the district attorney's office as one of its first detectives. Having built a solid reputation, Hamill ran unsuccessfully for sheriff in 1892 and 1894. The third time proved the charm. Elected in November 1898, the new sheriff started with a rare act for a politician, keeping a pledge for the local Afro-American League's campaign support. He had promised to appoint a black deputy, the first in L.A. County. Hamill made a solid choice in Julius Boyd Loving, who had served faithfully and fearlessly for nearly 40 years. Not joining Hamill's team was Martin Aguirre, who had gone north as warden of San Quentin Prison. Still, it wouldn't be the last time the two old law dogs hunted together. Though Hamill proved a strict leader, firing a deputy in mid-1899 for extorting license fees from a female saloon keeper, he retained some of cowboy copper ways. If you are insulted by a bully in the office, don't lick him there, he warned in a staff briefing. There are plenty of dark alleys. He learned the frustrations of leadership in October 1899 when a new U.S.-Mexico treaty prevented him from extraditing murder suspect Juan Puebla from below the border. To serve and protect. In January 1903, former deputy Will White became the new sheriff. Hamill spent much of the year eyeing the upcoming openings for wardens at Folsom and San Quentin. Aguirre was vacating the post, but ended it in the running for another job. The Los Angeles Police Department badly needed reform, and several city fathers felt Hamill was their man. In April 1904, he became the second person to have served both as L.A.'s county sheriff and its police chief. The other was his brother-in-law, George Guard. Vowing to make L.A.'s police force second to none in the United States, Hamill answered complaints that vice of every kind had full sway in the past by directing raids on opium dens, proposing licensing to combat crooked horse traders, selling deceased stock, and ordering a crackdown on mashers and indiscriminate makers of goo-goo eyes, harassing ladies on the streets. In the latter cases, the LA Record reported his orders implied that it may be necessary for an ambulance to bring in the offender. Looking forward, Hamill replaced a horse-drawn patrol wagon with an electric model, capable of 20 miles per hour, and doubling as an ambulance. He also urged upgrades to the receiving hospital, the city's only emergency facility, which operated under LAPD's umbrella. Hamill dealt swiftly with misconduct. His first official act was suspending a patrolman for intoxication. He later relieved three officers for extorting protection money from prostitutes. But he rewarded diligence, supporting a plan devised by several sergeants for a relief association to assist sick and injured officers and provide burial expenses for line-of-duty deaths. In November 1904, Hamill was himself accused of misconduct by none other than the Mexican government. Receiving word that Juan Puebla, the murderer who eluded his extradition efforts as sheriff, was frequenting Campo in the desert east of San Diego, Hamill and a police detective headed south. When they returned with the fugitive in irons, Puebla cried foul, claiming Mexican ruffians had waylaid him south of the border and delivered him to the lawman. If the line between the two countries became dim or uncertain, the LA Times unconcernably remarked, or was mysteriously moved a bit just to suit circumstances, it would not be strange. Diplomatic kerfluffle aside, Puebla was convicted and packed off to San Quentin, and Los Angeles's city dads reappointed Hamill for another year. A July 1905 LA Herald spread headlined, "Police Force is Model Army," praised Hamill's leadership and detailed improvements on his watch. In further innovations, he upgraded the department's telephone system to a central exchange, proposed a citywide alarm system, and, owing to a plague of scorchers, speeders, on city streets, recommended examination and licensing of automobile drivers. Despite praise from press and politicos, Hamill tendered his resignation in August. He was mum on his reasons, but friends and city councilmen cited frustration with meddling by the mayor. Whatever his reasons, Hamill's trusted subordinate, Captain Walter Obel, replaced him in October. By April 1906, he was back in the county sheriff's race, and in November, he was elected to a four-year term. A sheriff with horsepower. Back behind the sheriff's star, Hamill continued exploring new ideas, his greatest innovation being the introduction of motor vehicles. The Thor motorcycles he fielded allowed deputies to answer hurry-up calls, but he was best known for his personal vehicle, a specially outfitted seven-seater 1908 Locomobile touring car. With Deputy Billy Fryer at the wheel, Hamill and his big red car became a familiar, fearsome sight on the county streets and side roads. He was possibly the first Western sheriff to hunt crooks in an automobile. When robber Lewis the Rabbit Willie broke jail in February 1908, Hammer and Fryer nabbed him within minutes. In May, with L.A. Police Chief Edward Kern riding along, they aided the hunt for the killer of Hamill's LAPD successor, Walter Obel. Hamill's most high-profile vehicular pursuit came in January 1909. With Fryer and old pal Martin Aguirre, now his deputy, he scoured the county for a cowboy drifter named John Arizona Jack Allen, who had shot and killed Deputy Constable Charles de Morinville at Newhall in the desert north of Los Angeles. Crisscrossing 200 miles of rugged terrain, using Allen's own dog to help track and twice cutting off his escape, the lawmen cornered their quarry at a ranch mere miles from the shooting site. Suspecting Allen was hiding in a barn, Hamill sent in the dog, and the pup's overjoyed barking betrayed his master. When Allen scuttled from his hidey hole and ran for the trees, Hamill threw down on him with a Winchester, and Aguirre snapped on the cuffs. In a jiffy, the big red car was shuttling Allen to the county jail. Hamill's 1907-10 term was also distinguished by his hiring of Eugene Biscales, later L.A. County Sheriff, and his part in investigating the 1910 bombing of the Los Angeles Times building. Next term, he added yet another first to the Sheriff's Department, echoing the nepotism that kicked off his career. In 1912, Hamill installed the department's first female deputy, his sister-in-law, Margaret Q. Adams. In March 1913, Hamill's locomobile, having logged nearly 200,000 miles, was featured in a Times article, "Bad Ones Fear This Machine." The old red automobile, said the paper, had seen more action and romance than any galloping foam-flecked steed carrying a frontier sheriff over mountain and desert in pursuit of desperate outlaws. Buried in the piece was Hamill's petitioning the county for a more modern, high-powered car. The auto, like the sheriff, was nearing the end of a long, colorful career. In November 1914, John Klein, sheriff from 1893 to 94, defeated Hamill for re-election. Following William Hamill's death on New Year's Day, 1932, his funeral's honor guard included trailblazers Julius Loving, L.A.'s pioneering black deputy, and Eugene Biscales, who had been first superintendent of the California Highway Patrol and would become L.A. County Sheriff in December, holding the job for a record 26 years. It was a fitting tribute for an old lawman who had blazed some trails of his own. True West Magazine, July-August 2024 edition. Renegades of the Rails by Art T. Burton. Railroads were open season for Oklahoma and Indian Territory outlaw gangs. Glenn Shirley, the late historian of Oklahoma's frontier history of lawmen and outlaws, said there were more stagecoach and train robberies in the Twin Territories than anywhere on the western frontier. The first railroad to enter pre-state Oklahoma in 1871 was the Missouri, Kansas, and Texas Railroad, known by the pioneers and locals as the Katy. The first Katy train robbery on record was committed by a band of Cherokees. It occurred some 10 miles north of the new Red River city of Denison, Texas, in the Choctaw Nation during the summer of 1873. The bandits were said to have taken in a sum of $2,000 in cash, plus a sizable load of rings and watches from the passengers. Train robberies in the Oklahoma and Indian Territories got worse after 1890, when the Oklahoma Territory was formed. By that time, there were more railroads traversing the territories. In May 1891, the Dalton Gang robbed an AT&SF, Santa Fe, railroad train in Wharton, Oklahoma Territory, now Perry, Oklahoma. Bob Dalton and George Newcomb waited at the depot for the express to arrive. The rest of the gang waited at the stockyards. When the train pulled in the station, Dalton and Newcomb jumped into the cab of the steam engine and, with drawn guns, told the engineer to move the train to the stockyards and stop there. The engineer did as he was told. At the stockyards, the engineer and fireman were led to the express car and ordered to tell the express messenger to open the door. Shots were fired into the door and the messenger opened it. If passengers stuck their heads out of windows, the gang members would fire shots alongside the train. The Dalton gang was able to get two bags of money. Emmett Dalton later claimed the gang got $14,000 for the robbery. The Daltons. In June of 1892, the Dalton gang robbed the Santa Fe Railroad at Red Rock, 15 miles north of Wharton, Oklahoma Territory. The Dalton gang learned there would be $75,000 in Indian annuity money transported via the Santa Fe on June 1st. The Daltons had a well-known outlaw named Bill Doolin with them as they robbed the train. The gang was only able to open one of the two safes in the messenger car and got no more than $11,000. After this robbery, a large contingent of lawmen were put in the field to find the Daltons, but were unsuccessful. The Santa Fe Railroad offered $500 for the arrest of each member of the gang. By this time in the Twin Territories, it was reported there were 11 men in the Dalton gang, including the brothers Bob, Gratt, and Emmett Dalton. On Thursday night of July 14th, 1892, the number 2 Katy train was northbound when it made a stop at Adair in the Cherokee Nation, some 20 miles south of Veneta Indian Territory, at around 9:42 p.m. The station agent was ordered at gunpoint to flag the train down. Two armed men quickly took command of the steam engine, while the others took the conductor and trainmen in charge. Unbeknownst to the outlaws, a posse was on board the train to protect it against robbers. The posse included Railroad Detective John J. Kinney, Deputy U.S. Marshal Sid Johnson, three members of the United States Indian Police, Captain Charles LaFleur, Alf McKay, and Bud Kell. The posse stepped off the train to confront the robbers, and almost immediately, Kinney, LaFleur, and Johnson were wounded. The lawmen took refuge in a coal house. The outlaws used the trainmen as human shields during the gunfight. The lawmen stopped firing for fear of hitting one of the innocent workmen. Meanwhile, other members of the gang were pouring a steady stream of gunfire into the express car. The messenger opened the door and gave the robbers access to the car. The robbers looted the safe in the express car for $17,000, but were not successful in getting the station agent to open the safe in the station. While riding out of town, the gang shot two unarmed doctors sitting outside the drugstore. Dr. D.L. Goff died from his gunshot, and Dr. T.S. Youngblood lost a foot to his gun wound. After this robbery, the Katy Railroad placed a $5,000 reward for each member of the gang, which included the Dalton brothers, Dick Broadwell, Charlie Pierce, Bill Doolin, and William Power. Open season on trains. A second train robbery happened at Wharton on September 8, 1892. Five men held up the train, captured the express car, opened the safe, and found nothing worth taking. They left with two baskets of grapes. There was a third train robbery at Wharton on November 8, 1892. Three white men held up a Santa Fe southbound passenger train. Robbers only got a few small packages and took the messenger's Winchester rifle and revolvers. In January of 1893, two of the robbers, Jesse Jackson and Scott Bruner, were captured after having a running gunfight with a posse led by Black Deputy U.S. Marshals Rufus Cannon and Ike Rogers. At close range, Cannon shotgunned off one of Jackson's arms during the gunfight. The outlaws were turned over to Deputy U.S. Marshal Heck Thomas in Bartlesville, IT. Another man in custody, named Ernest Lewis, turned state's evidence and testified about the robbery to authorities. On October 20, 1894, a Missouri Pacific Railroad passenger train was robbed at Coretta Creek Nation, now OK, Oklahoma, 5 miles south of the town of Wagner. A gang member threw a siding switch while the train was going about 25 miles an hour. The train went into the siding and ran into some boxcars on the track. The robbers were able to loot the local safe in the express car, but couldn't open the through safe. The passengers were robbed of their money and valuables as the robbers went through the coach cars. The bandits shot out every window in the train and even the steam gauge and gauge pump in the locomotive. Black Creek Freedman outlaw Bus Lucky and his all-black gang comprised of Bob Elsie and brothers Frank, Henry, and Will Smith carried out the robbery. Texas Jack. Katy's premier passenger train, the northbound Katy Flyer, was robbed on the night of November 13th, 1894. The leader was a white man named Nathaniel Texas Jack Reed with three tough black desperados, Bus Lucky, Tom Root, and Will Smith. The robbery took place at Blackstone Switch near Wybark, 8 miles north of Muskogee, Indian Territory. Again, the outlaws switched the train to a siding from the main line. riding as guards in the express car were lawmen Bud Ledbetter and Peyton Tolbert, legendary lawmen of the Indian Territory. In the express car was $60,000 in gold bullion and silver. A furious gun battle ensued, and the outlaws made no progress in capturing the express car. While the gunfight was taking place, Texas Jack went through the chair car and robbed the passengers of $460, 8 watches, and 3 pistols. On leaving the scene, Ledbetter shot Texas Jack with his Winchester and seriously wounded him. Bus Lucky picked up Jack, and the outlaws made a quick escape on horseback. Lucky was later captured by authorities and convicted by testimony from Root, who turned state's evidence. Root was later killed in a gunfight. Smith was never captured. In Arkansas, Reed turned himself in, and Judge Isaac C. Parker gave him a 5-year sentence. When released, Reed became an evangelist and traveled in Wild West shows. A southbound Rock Island Railroad passenger train was robbed on April 3, 1895, in the Oklahoma Territory. A group of 5 men, led by William Tulsa Jack Blake and Red Buck Waitman, forced their way aboard and robbed the express car of $400. They also stole jewelry and high-valued watches from panic-stricken passengers, whom they threatened to shoot if they offered any resistance. The outlaws were able to get away, but Blake and Waitman were both killed later by U.S. deputy marshals in the Oklahoma Territory. Al Jennings. On August 16, 1897, lawyer-turned-outlaw Al Jennings had assembled a gang that included 2 hard cases from the Bill Doolin gang, Little Dick West and Dynamite Dick Clifton. They decided to rob the Santa Fe passenger train at Edmond, Oklahoma Territory. The outlaws were able to get aboard the engine and ordered the engineer to stop the train. The gang tried unsuccessfully to blow the safe in the baggage car, so they robbed the passengers of their valuables. The gang rode east toward the Indian Territory and were seen by black farmers near the town of Arcadia. Deputy U.S. Marshal Bud Ledbetter later caught Al Jennings and the Creek Nation. Jennings was convicted and sent to prison. Later, West and Clifton were both killed by federal lawmen in the territories. This is just a recap of a few of the train robberies in the Oklahoma and Indian territories during the frontier era. A train ticket in the Twin Territories could be very exciting and unpredictable, as well as deadly and dangerous. True West Magazine, July-August 2024 edition. Northfield, Minnesota, by Peter Corbett. The James Younger Gang met its match in a frontier bank. At the centennial of the nation's founding, Northfield, Minnesota was a bucolic river town on the plains 40 miles south of St. Paul, with a tidy business block, flour mill, railroad, and 2 small colleges. Hard-working immigrant farmers, Norwegians, Swedes, and Czechoslovakians, populated the area. They went to church, bought goods in Northfield, and kept their earnings at the First National Bank of Northfield. Roughly 2 months after Independence Day in 1876, the James Younger Gang disturbed Northfield's tranquility when 8 bandits rode into town to rob the bank. A trio entered, demanding that clerks open the vaults. "Get your guns, boys! They're robbing the bank!" cried hardware merchant J.S. Allen after witnessing the robbery in progress and alerting bystanders. Inside, a gang member pulled a knife on Joseph Lee Haywood, who refused to open the vault. "Damn you! Open the safe or we will slit your throat from ear to ear!" Haywood still resisted. The bandits fatally shot him and fled with a small amount of cash from the teller's cage. Outside the bank, armed townsfolk killed 2 bandits, shot 1 of their horses, and wounded Cole and Bob Younger. Jesse and Frank James escaped, but after a weeks-long manhunt, a posse killed another gang member and captured the 3 Younger brothers at Hanska Slough, a swampy area in southwest Minnesota. The brave men of Northfield brought down the James Younger Gang, which for a decade terrorized frontier towns, robbing banks, trains, and stagecoaches, and eluding capture. The magnitude of Northfield's brave stand against the James Younger gang is long remembered in these parts of Minnesota. In fact, the First National Bank of Northfield is a museum operated by the Northfield Historical Society. Plus, Defeat of Jesse James Days has been celebrated here for 76 years. An elaborate reenactment of the seven-minute robbery and shootout packs Northfield's historic district with visitors the weekend after Labor Day. Local historian Tim Freeland said the bank is largely intact as it was on September 7, 1876. The museum is a popular year-round attraction in Northfield. Everything is original, down to the floorboards, the spittoons, the clock, the old stove, and the hanging lights, he said, while the teller cages were rebuilt based on photographs taken the day after the robbery. One grim reminder of the violent attack is blood splatters on a bank ledger from the shot that killed Haywood, the town hero. He would not give up the money, $15,300, which was the life savings of a lot of farmers, Freeland said. It was Carleton College money and St. Olaf's College money. The $15,300 in the bank vault was the equivalent of about $450,000 today, he added. Defeat of Jesse James Days, with the shorthand of DJJD, is set for September 4th through the 8th. Four reenactments will be staged Saturday, with two each on Friday and Sunday. 41 events are planned, including a popular PRCA rodeo, fine arts festival, antique car show, soapbox derby, carnival rides, music, food trucks, and a tractor pull. Of course, Northfield is worth a visit that goes beyond the tragedy of 1876. St. Olaf and Carleton colleges have beautiful campuses and bring art and cultural resources to this city of about 20,000 residents. Carleton includes the Perlman Teaching Museum with an impressive art collection and the White Center for Creativity, a 250-seat theater. St. Olaf is known for its choirs, orchestras, bands, and the St. Olaf Christmas Festival. The college's Flatten Art Museum has more than 4,000 paintings, photographs, sculptures, and ceramics. The Northfield Arts Guild has a performing arts theater and several art galleries in town. Outdoor activities include biking and hiking along the Cannon River, at the Cowling Arboretum, and a short hike to a waterfall at nearby Nurse Strand Big Wood State Park. Seasonally, cross-country skiing and snowshoeing are popular winter activities in Northfield. In summer, the Riverwalk Market Fair on Saturdays from June to October features vendors with fresh produce, flowers, arts and crafts, and musical entertainment. And what would be a college town without libations at local watering holes? Options include the Loon Liquor Distillery, Tanzenwald Brewing Company, and Eminent Brewing. Where history meets the highway. First stop, Northfield Chamber of Commerce and Tourism, 19 Bridge Square. Online, northfieldchamber.com. Robbers foiled at town's historic bank. Visit the Northfield Historical Society Museum within the First National Bank of Northfield, where a brave bank clerk refused to open the vault for the James Younger gang. Online, northfieldhistory.org. Ask directions to Old Store Restaurant. Try the Swedish meatballs or fried walleye at the Old Store Restaurant, a Northfield landmark established in 1889. Online, O-O-L-E, storerestaurant.com. Try a Loon in the afternoon. Visit the Loon Liquor Distillery for a craft cocktail or pick up a bottle of Loonman vodka, gin, rum, or Loonshine whiskey. Online, loonliquors.com. Perk up your Blue Monday. Start the day with a cup of Joe along with a bagel, muffin, or croissant at the Goodbye Blue Monday Coffee House. Online, gbmcoffee.com. True West Magazine, July-August 2024 edition. Flagship Fare by Sherry Monahan. Dining on the Super Fay Super Chief was always a highlight of cross-country railway travel. The Super Chief was the flagship train of the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railway and was built by the Budd Company in late 1936. It made a round trip once a week between Chicago and Los Angeles that took almost 40 hours. The train's eight cars included a baggage car, a dining car called the Cochiti, a lounge car known as the Acoma, and sleeping cars known as the Orabi, Taos, Laguna, Isleta, and Navajo. The Super Chief was the first diesel-electric-powered cross-country passenger train in America. It got the nickname the Train of the Stars because of the celebrities who rode in comfort on the Super Chief between the two big cities. In 1950, the train was upgraded with modern touches, and the turquoise room in the dome car was added. The dome car was divided into five rooms that also included a lower cocktail lounge, the main cocktail lounge, a parlor observation dome, and a private writing desk room. The turquoise room was a private dining room and cocktail service that catered to private parties for 6 to 10 people. The room was decorated in turquoise, silver, and gold vinyl light on the side walls, and the end walls contained accordion-type sliding doors covered in the same pattern. The main dining areas, where most passengers dined, was decorated in a romantic southwestern color scheme exclusively designed for the Super Chief. The dining cars were fitted with refrigeration units that used dry ice for cooling to keep meat, vegetables, and other perishables from spoiling. The food served on the Super Chief was considered gourmet due to the Hollywood connection. Some of the chefs included Frank Cotton, Carlos Gardini, Armand Tomei, and Cloris Dale. Some of the more elaborate items on the menu were freshly caught mountain trout, sturgeon, pheasant, partridge, caviar, curry, imported wine, and champagne. Frequent requests for birthday cakes were made from passengers, as were special dietary needs. One lady said she was on a fresh peach diet and had to have them, despite it being January. Another gentleman requested a very specific meal that included a piece of potato cut into 1 by 3 inch long piece, a carrot 3 inches long, and a steak exactly 2.5 inches thick and an inch square. He provided the chef with a ruler so he could be precise. Other menu items included Hungarian veal goulash, toasted French bread, and apple dollar pancakes with huckleberry syrup. This lobster dish is an example of that opulence. It was offered on the gargantuan menu offered in the turquoise room, which was the famous private dining room of the Super Chief. This was offered by Chef Carlos Gardini. Lobster Americaine. Servings: one large portion or two small portions. Ingredients: 1 2-pound lobster, boiled. 4 tablespoons butter. 1 tablespoon minced celery. 1 teaspoon minced carrots. 1 teaspoon minced leeks. 1 teaspoon minced shallots. 1/2 garlic cloved, minced. 2 tablespoons cognac. 2 tablespoons flour. 1/4 cup broth. 2 tablespoons white wine. 2 tomatoes, peeled and chopped. 1 dash of salt. 1 dash of pepper. 1 dash of cayenne pepper. Directions: remove meat from shell and cut into pieces 1 inch thick. Melt butter, add minced vegetables, and sauté several minutes without browning. Add lobster meat and garlic and continue cooking for 5 minutes. Add cognac and set aflame. Blend in the flour, add broth, and stir until smooth and slightly thickened. Add wine and chopped tomatoes, season to taste, and cook slowly for 20 minutes. Recipe adapted from Fred Harvey's Super Chief Recipe Book, 1958. True West Magazine, July-August 2024 edition. From the Basin to the Plains by Candy Moulton. Discover Wyoming on a road trip to Cody, Casper, and Cheyenne. Scotsman Peter McCulloch ramrodded a crew that trailed 3,800 head of cattle into Wyoming's Bighorn Basin in 1879. The herd was owned by Judge William A. Carter and Carter Cattle Company, which operated in southwest Wyoming near Fort Bridger. His herd became the first cattle trailed across Wyoming to form the basis of the industry in the region southeast of Yellowstone National Park. McCulloch established a headquarters for the new cattle operation on a stream he called Carter Creek, and he also named Carter Mountain. The mountain is a dividing line between the Wood River drainage near Metisi and the South Fork of the Shoshone River west of Cody, a town named for the frontiersman turned entertainer William F. Buffalo Bill Cody. Settlement in the Bighorn Basin increased as more livestock owners moved to the area and farmers came as well. The town of Cody, named for Buffalo Bill, developed when federal reclamation projects provided much-needed water for irrigation. But Buffalo Bill's fame attracted hunters and dignitaries from across the world. Caroline Lockhart, a writer who owned and edited the Cody Enterprise newspaper, was a founder of the Cody Stampede, a rodeo that is still going strong every 4th of July. In 2024, the Stampede will be held July 1st through the 4th. If you love rodeo and can't be in Cody over Independence Day, then don't miss a chance to attend the Cody Night Rodeo, which is held every night from June 1st to August 31st. The Cody Heritage Museum, located a short walk from the Irma Hotel, which was built by Buffalo Bill and named for his daughter, highlights Lockhart's story and stories of other townspeople. Another few blocks away is the world-class Buffalo Bill Center of the West, with its museums devoted to the area's art, wildlife, Indian tribes, firearms, and, of course, the great showman himself. Casper. A journey from Bighorn Basin to the eastern plains of Wyoming can be as diverse as you want. Head south to Thermopolis and drive the inspiring Wind River Canyon. Then see the wide open spaces between Shoshone and Casper. You could also drive one of the two routes over the Bighorn Mountains, the northern route through Lovell and Shell, and then on to Ranchester and Sheridan is a spectacular drive, and you can take time to visit the Medicine Wheel, a site that is particularly important for American Indian tribes. A more southern route is through Warland and Ten Sleep to Buffalo. It has equally awesome views. Any of these highways lead to Casper, located at the last crossing of the North Platte, used by overland immigrants during the period 1843 to 68. Those traveling the Oregon, California, and Mormon Pioneer Trails followed the Platte and North Platte rivers across Nebraska and Wyoming. But just west of today's Casper, that great river turns to the south, and the immigrants continued west toward the Sweetwater River and south past, the gateway to their new homes. Mormon pioneers built a ferry at the river crossing in 1847 to serve California trail traffic in 1852. An experienced mountain trader named John Baptiste Richard Reshaw constructed a bridge that eased travel issues for people needing to get across the water course. Later, Louis Gagnard built another bridge a few miles upstream. By 1862, a military post had been established at the Upper Platte Bridge crossing and became known as the Platte Bridge Station. The battles of Platte Bridge and Red Buttes, with Lakota and Cheyenne fighters on July 26, 1865, resulted in the death of more than 20 soldiers from the 11th Ohio and 11th Kansas Volunteer Cavalry Unions. Subsequently, the post was renamed for Lieutenant Casper Collins, who died in the first battle of the day. The city also took his name, with a difference in spelling. Fort Casper has been recreated and is operated as a historic attraction by the city of Casper. annual reenactments at the fort involve events in late July to commemorate the two battles in 1865. The fort also comes alive in early December with a living history celebration of Christmas at the fort. While in Casper, learn about the trails at the National Historic Trail Interpretive Center. But take a step far back in time and visit the Tate Museum with its paleontological collections. Traveling from Casper to Cheyenne, Wyoming's high plains spread out to the east and south from a mountain landscape that includes Casper Mountain and Laramie Peak. South of Casper, take a detour to Ayers Natural Bridge, a site along the Overland Trails which has a picnic area. Another side trip to Guernsey gives you a chance to walk in the pathway of deep ruts carved by overland and military traffic on the historic trails, or view the pioneer inscriptions at Register Cliff. Cheyenne. Like the Buffalo Bill Center of the West in Cody, Cheyenne also has an iconic attraction, Cheyenne Frontier Days, a 10-day show always held the last full week and a couple of weekends in July. Started in 1897 as a place for cowboys to test their ability in riding bucking broncs, the Daddy, as the event is known, has certainly evolved. Today's celebration includes four parades featuring a collection of horse-drawn vehicles, three free pancake breakfasts, daily rodeos with the top competitors in the hemisphere, chuck wagon cook-offs, Indian dancing, and specialty events. Learn more about the history of the event at the CFD Old West Museum. Tap into other history in Cheyenne at Messenger's Old West Museum or Nelson's Museum of the West, or enjoy time in Depot Square in Cheyenne's downtown historic district in front of the Union Pacific Depot. Look for the oversized cowboy boots and the running horse atop the Wrangler store. Take a drive west of the city on Wyoming Highway 210, locally known as the Happy Jack Road, to Kurt Gowdy State Park, which has fishing, boating, camping, picnicking, and hiking opportunities. Or continue to the Medicine Bow National Forest and the Vidawu area with its massive rock formations. A wide spot in the road. Step into a missile launch facility. Learn about some of Wyoming's contemporary history at Quebec One Missile Alert Facility, MAF, located 30 miles north of Cheyenne. Now a Wyoming State Historic Site, the structure was a United States Air Force ICBM launch control facility. Built in 1962 as part of the Minuteman Missile Program, it was operated by the 400th Missile Squadron. It later became a peacekeeper missile site until it was decommissioned in 2005. It was later gifted to the state of Wyoming for the interpretation facility. New exhibits opened this spring. Tours of the underground control capsule are offered seasonally. Good Eats and Grubs. Good Grub. Cassie's Supper Club, Cody. The Irma Hotel, Cody. Eggington's, Casper. Fire Rock Steakhouse, Casper. The Omelette House, Cheyenne. The Albany, Cheyenne. Good Lodging. The Chamberlain Inn, Cody. Best Western Premier Ivy Inn and Suites, Cody. Buffalo Bill State Park Campground, Cody. Hampton Inn and Suites, Cody. Ramcota, Casper. Nagel Inn Bed and Breakfast, Cheyenne. Little America Hotel and Resort, Cheyenne. Kurt Gowdy State Park Campground, Cheyenne. True West Magazine, July-August 2024 edition. Where Did the Loot Go? By Mark Boardman. Whatever happened to the $97,000 from the Reno gang's last heist? This is one of those find-the-money stories, and it's one that has attracted treasure hunters for more than 150 years. It goes back to May 22, 1868. Up to a dozen members of the Reno gang stopped at a Jeffersonville, Madison, and Indianapolis train at a watering station in southern Indiana. The outlaws had prior intelligence about its main load. Express car safes held about $97,000 in government bonds and notes. In the process of the job, one of the crew was killed and two others hurt. The gang made a clean getaway with the loot. For the moment. Vigilantes lynched 11 of the outlaws in three separate incidents over the next 6.5 months. But ongoing searches, some official, some by treasure hunters, never turned up the stolen money. Where is it? I've been studying the Renos for some 30 years, and I've got some theories. First, three of the gang members, including leader Frank Reno, managed to escape temporarily to Canada. While fighting extradition to the U.S., Reno offered thousands of dollars in bribes to stay in Canada. Honest officials said no. I believe Frank Reno and the others took at least some of their robbery loot to their north of the border hideout, and the outlaws likely left at least some with a Canadian cohorts. The rest of the money? Many believe it was buried around Seymour, Indiana, the gang's headquarters. But the Renos, who had pulled in many more thousands of dollars in criminal activities over the previous few years, had never before put money in the ground, in caves, etc. They spent it, often to grease the palms of local officials and business people in an effort to avoid issues in their hometown. They blew the rest of it on high living. That was the historic pattern. Why would the bandits change a successful process? I believe local businesses in particular took the notes and laundered them in various fashion, giving the Renos clean cash and keeping some for themselves. There is at least some evidence of that. In the early 1870s, one of Seymour's most successful merchants and property owners, John Pfaffenberger, tried to cash one of the $500 notes from the robbery at a Cincinnati bank. The note numbers had been circulated to money institutions around the Midwest in 1868, and some bankers were still on the lookout. Pfaffenberger was arrested and tried for passing stolen notes. He was found not guilty since the prosecution couldn't prove that he knew they were illegal. His reputation probably played a role in that verdict. The rest was never discovered. I don't believe the loot is in a hole in the ground or some cave in southern Indiana. Sorry, treasure hunters. It's long gone, and most of those who profited from the stolen money were not the robbers themselves.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.